That's totally okay. Thanks for calling in to do the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And
no problem.
Let me make sure I have my notes over to the side. All right, so let me do a quick intro for you here. All right, for this week's podcast, I have gone to academia. She is the chair of the Department of History at the University of Buffalo. She has written extensively on topics of gender and race. Her book, Race, Riots, and Roller Coasters, The Struggle Over Segregated Recreation in America, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2012, is one of very, very few books that really reviews the topic of the amusement industry and racial segregation. And she is pretty much the expert on this subject. Dr. Victoria Wolcott, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
So a couple items here really quickly to begin with. Obviously, you wrote this book in 2012. Prior to that, in 2006, you wrote an article that appeared in the Journal of American History on the Crystal Beach riot. Kind of based on what I've read in the book, it seems like that article sort of spawned the book. Can you maybe give a little more info about that, kind of how the book and that article came to be?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a direct connection. So the Journal of American History, I got what's called a revise and resubmit from them. And when I initially had written the article, it was more narrowly just about that particular incident in Crystal Beach, and they asked me to broaden it and make it, you know, a larger story. So I went to the Library of Congress, and I started looking in NAACP and Urban League papers, and I found literally boxes of files of all sorts of incidents nationwide, of recreation riots and segregation issues around places of amusement. So that at that point, I revised the article and got it published. And I realized that there was a bigger story here that was largely untold.
Yeah, going back, I remember you had actually mentioned, I think you'd seen a PBS special about Crystal Beach. And there's a lot of these specials which have been produced by various public broadcasting networks throughout the years, mm-hmm. Particularly about amusement parks that kind of go over people's recollections of them and how much they love them. And you basically were like, well, it's very nice that all these people love Crystal Beach. And, you know, for an amusement park, a traditional amusement park, it was apparently a pretty decent one. But they didn't really mention or kind of glossed over the whole fact that they didn't allow African Americans to go to the park for a long period of time.
Right. Yeah, and that's a complicated history because the Black community in Buffalo was quite small until the 1950s. And then when you get that sort of massive migration, that's when you start having issues at the park in some ways. But there is this whole nostalgia, really, industry around the older traditional trolley parks and amusement parks. There's multiple documentaries about Crystal Beach. They still sell memorabilia around Buffalo to, you know, memorialize the park. But there's really no discussion at all of this major race riot that was investigated by the FBI and made, you know, headlines around the country. And the fact that it was because of that riot that they stopped running the Canadiana, which was the steamboat, very beloved steamboat that did excursions to the park. So that's just really absent almost entirely from kind of the public understanding of the park's history, which isn't to say it wasn't a great park or that people's childhoods were enhanced by it. But this larger history is sublimated among all the nostalgia.
And it should be clear too, when we talk about this park, that this isn't simply an issue that was isolated to Crystal Beach. This is something that is particularly in the upper Midwest following the Great Migration. After World War II, you see it was always the case at these parks, but it became exponentially more of an issue following the migration of African Americans to the northern part of the United States after World War II. But you see this at Coney Island, Cincinnati, you see it at Riverview in Chicago, you see it at a number of facilities. Maybe take us into a little bit of how the public's perception allowed the public really just see segregation as a Southern issue and not an issue of the North. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's something that's been challenged by historians, but I don't think that's gotten out to the general public yet, the extent to which public accommodations, in fact, were segregated in the North into the 1960s in some cases. So you have, you know, public transportation was not segregated, but often African Americans could not go to department stores or go to hotels. There were restaurants that were segregated. But amusements in general, roller skating rinks, particularly swimming pools and amusement parks, generally had some form of segregation because there were places where there was concerns about racial violence, about interracial mixing. So they didn't, and these violated civil rights statutes on the state level. In states like Ohio, had laws on the book, that were civil rights laws, but it was very difficult to actually bring those lawsuits to the courts. So it really took the efforts of the NAACP and legal activists, as well as the Congress of Racial Equality and civil rights activists, to begin to shift that a bit. And I should say, you know, it varies, right? So Coney Island in Cincinnati was just a white-only park completely. And that's partly a reflection of its geography, being on the border there of the Mason-Dixon line. So that's, you know, one kind of model. Other places like Euclid Park, for example, and this is in Cleveland, they basically allowed African Americans to enter the park grounds, but they could not go to the swimming pool or the roller skating rink or some other places where they were, you know, deemed to be white only kinds of areas. Palisades Park as well was like that in New Jersey. And then other parks were open one day a week sometimes for African Americans. That was usually a Monday. Or sometimes open only one day a year for African Americans. So there are different strategies of segregation that different parks use, kind of depending on geography and local custom and so forth.
Yeah, and this is a pretty wide list of parks. I mean, Cedar Point did not allow African Americans in their hotel. Kennywood, I believe, did not allow African Americans in the pool or the dance hall. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. Right, and the dance hall, that's the other facility where they would not want racial mixing.
Yeah, so this is you know, even parks that have lasted into the modern day, that, you know, again, are beloved parks, this is a part of their history, and it's generally ignored almost completely in historical basis. Obviously, in the South, you know, segregation was, I must say, it was more of a serious issue, but it was perhaps more pronounced than it was in the North. But they didn't really have the trolley parks due to not having trolleys. So it's not really seen quite as much, but what would you say, were there similarities, or was it more severe in the South than perhaps the North?
It was in some ways more severe, but you're absolutely right in terms of amusement parks. There's so many fewer of those traditional trolley parks in the South. But certainly in the case of, say, swimming pools, they would be entirely segregated in the South in the way that it was slightly more spotty in the North. You also had the opportunities of African Americans in the South to develop their own. There's not a huge number of these, but there's some amusement parks and amusement sort of spaces for Blacks only. So there's one in New Orleans, for example, that's a Black-only amusement park, that's Black-owned. They actually allowed whites to come in, I should say, but a Black-owned park. So you have a little bit more of a tradition of kind of an entrepreneurial Black businesses around recreation in the South, which is interesting as well. But generally, those commercial amusements were not as well developed in the South as they were in the North.
All right. And then kind of staying along these lines here, we've mentioned swimming pools a few times and aquatics facilities. Really, and to me, this was one of the most striking things when I read your book that I was not aware of at all, was how the segregation of swimming pools, and a lot of these swimming pools were constructed during the New Deal on the 1980s by the Works Progress Administration. Those were largely segregated across the country. And really, as a part of what happened with that segregation, it seems to have carried forward with there being a disparity in the capabilities of swimming for African Americans and attitudes towards swimming.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's not only and those New Deal swimming pools were beautiful, by the way. They were really lavish and really wonderful spaces. And as you know, Blacks were largely excluded from them, even though their tax dollars was going to pay for them. But also large swimming pools in public high schools too. So when schools are beginning to be desegregated, that becomes an issue. And many high schools, when they become more integrated, close down their swimming pools completely. So the kind of education that high school students would get to learn how to swim goes away largely. which is really interesting. But there is a kind of cultural legacy that's there. So it's a good example of how even when legal segregation goes away with Civil Rights Act and with activism, you have this sort of long-term ramifications that can last for decades later. So, and I certainly, the kind of issue around African-Americans in swimming is one of them. I think swimming was also, because where they ended up swimming was not these, you know, pools which had lifeguards, but often in what we call natural waters, like rivers and lakes and so forth. And that was much more dangerous. So there was also a kind of area around swimming and danger as well, that wasn't something they necessarily wanted to do. So there is a legacy of that, which is really fascinating.
Backing up a little bit here, we'll talk a little bit about your personal background. So I looked at your CV, as anybody who's going to do an interview probably should, of an academic. I noticed that as far as your education, you got your undergraduate at NYU. Your PhD was actually at the University of Michigan. Most of your appointments have been in Western New York, and obviously you're there now. Are you originally from the Western New York area?
No, I'm from New Jersey, and which is one of the reasons I ended up at NYU. So I'm a typical New Jersey person. So East Coast, but I've lived in Western New York for a long time, and you know, certainly spent a fair amount of time in Michigan in graduate school. My first book was about Detroit, so I have a fairly good sense of the Midwest, and I would consider Western New York actually more part of the Midwest culturally in many ways than it is part of the East Coast. So I have my feet in both places.
What drew you not only just to history as a topic, but specifically history of what is largely an urban history, discussing cities, particularly of the post-war era?
Yeah, so I was, you know, when I was an undergraduate, I thought I was going to go to law school and major in political science, and quickly realized that what I liked about my political science classes was the history component. And this was actually a period in the late 80s, early 90s, where it looked like the academic job market might open up, which totally did not happen, but it worked out for me. So I decided to go actually into labor history. That was my idea. But when I went to graduate school, I realized, you know, through, you know, working with professors and so forth, that the history of African-American women and labor was almost completely not written, which led to my first book, which is about Black women in Detroit during the Great Migration. So overall, I mean, I'm a 20th century historian, and, you know, Du Bois said that the story of the 20th century is the story of the color line, which is something I very much embrace. So that to understand 20th century history, you have to place race really at the center of it in many ways. So that's one thing. And also, I do have a sort of social justice commitment in terms of my political identity, I guess one could say. So I was attracted to kind of these questions about race and segregation, which of course brings you into cities as a sort of natural outcome of that.
So I guess that this kind of brings us up to sort of the primary portion of history that I guess would be most relevant to this, which is going to be the civil rights battle that took place in the 1950s and 1960s. It's during this period of time that we see a number of amusement parks close. It's not necessarily entirely because of the civil rights movement and this integration issue, but there's also a shift in terms of the amusement industry to go to the suburbs, which I guess right. Maybe you can directly tie that in as well. Let's talk a little bit about what exactly happened in the 1950s and 1960s, because obviously there's the riot that we mentioned at Crystal Beach, but was not the only sort of incident like that.
Yeah, there's this, particularly, you know, in the second half of the 1960s, there's a number of major incidents in places like Glen Echo and others. So the civil rights struggle, but not just activists, you know, in the classic way that you would think, but ordinary African Americans increasingly started to challenge the segregation. And then when they were turned away, they would go to the local NAACP or a local civil rights organization who might file a lawsuit and then do picketing and so forth. So you have all that kind of activism going on. And in some ways, it culminates with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and which these parks are forcefully, you know, at that stage, have to desegregate or else be in violation of the law, although there's plenty of attempts to try to privatize them and things like that to avoid the law. And one of the things that I found interesting is that the park owners also are beginning to realize that the land that these older amusement parks are on is enormously valuable. It's you know, close to cities or sometimes inside of cities, and that the amount of money to kind of keep the park up and to keep allowing this, you know, to grow and modernize and so forth wasn't worth it to them. So they sort of let the parks fall apart a bit in the second half of the 60s. And then you do have incidents of race riots happening in these parks, you know, conflagrations between whites and blacks in the park, sometimes between police and African-American youth. A lot of times it would be like an opening day sort of situation, you know, Memorial Day, where you'd have a large number of African-American teenagers who would show up, and that would be considered intimidating or problematic, either by the park police or by the white consumers at the park, and then you would have violence that would ensue. So the narrative becomes that these parks close down and kind of decline as a result of, you know, black race riots, essentially. That ignores the history of segregation, ignores white participation in that violence, and it also ignores the profit motive for actually getting rid of these parks and selling them off to developers. So there's all those things kind of feed into the development of the theme parks as an alternative to this older trolley park model. There's still a couple trolley parks out there, and they're great to visit. But for the most part, they're almost all completely gone. So
one interesting aspect about the book is it discusses some terms that have been used in the industry for, you know, over a century. Cleanliness and safety are often promoted as aspects of amusement parks. And until I read your book, I had never realized that there was an association between those things and segregation. It's not just that those parks wanted to say we're clean. Part of the we're clean is the fact that we don't have African Americans or people of color that come to this park. And then the safety aspect was also very often that they basically would argue that it was for the safety of African Americans to not come, which I think a lot of people don't grasp those things.
Yeah, so that it becomes a sort of code, a marketing code for a white-only space. And this isn't just true of amusement parks, but other spaces as well. So, you know, African-Americans, there's associations by the turn of the last century of African-Americans with the disease, and that's certainly the case with issues around swimming, this idea that you have to, you know, disinfect the pool after African-Americans swim in it, that kind of thing. And then the issue around safety. I mean, when you have groups of white and black teenagers together, there often was violence. So this was used as justification for segregation. You know, judges, police officers, mayors would often invoke public safety as a reason to maintain segregation. That as soon as you desegregate, you solve this violence. And that did happen, in fact. And therefore, to ensure public safety, these spaces needed to be segregated or closed down or privatized, which was another kind of way to go, sell it off to a private, you know, owner and that kind of thing. So it's really, it's interesting how those things are associated with you know, one and another. Civil rights activists, you know, groups like the Urban League and the NAACP and others, they would often say, okay, if you desegregate, we will send in our most, you know, respectable people into the park, will make sure that there's no disorder, we'll send in social workers and that kind of thing to make sure nothing, you know, goes wrong, to try to counteract those arguments. Of course, that's also somewhat problematic. But yeah, and that, I think, again, lasts past segregation. So, you know, nobody who's developing a marketing scheme now would think about safety and cleanliness as a code for whites only. But I think there is a way in which that lasts in the public imagination, even if it's unintentional.
We've mentioned, obviously, the Urban League and NAACP have been mentioned here already. Were there roles that other groups played? Like, for instance, labor unions were often cited as being very important in terms of integration in the United States, or at least attempts to integrate. Mm-hmm. What other groups may have been involved in these sort of civil rights movement items to try and desegregate American recreation?
Actually, the most important organization is the Congress of Racial Equality, which developed actually in the 40s, so before people ordinarily think of the movement starting. But the Congress of Racial Equality was interested in developing the strategy of radical pacifism, nonviolent direct action, basically. So they studied Gandhi and they studied the techniques of nonviolent direct action. And they went around the Midwest, the East Coast, the West Coast, tiny bit in the South, but mostly in the North. And they trained people in these actions. And they started in, you know, the mid-1940s to do sit-ins and stand-ins and other nonviolent action at roller skating rinks, parks, dance halls, swimming pools, all those kinds of spaces. So that's one thing I'm actually working on an article now, trying to give the Congress of Racial Equality more the credit that I think they deserve. Labor unions also, in the 1930s, you have the development of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or CIO, which was trying to organize interracially, unlike the older AFL unions. And often the CIO would have these outings, right? They'd want to bring their workers, their union workers, to a park, and that would cause all sorts of problems. So they act as a kind of leading wedge to try to desegregate some of these spaces. Also with the bowling alleys were also segregated, and the CIO had a central role in desegregating bowling alleys because they had teams that were interracial that were organized by labor unions. That was, you know, obviously in a city like Detroit or Buffalo, that would be really important. So by the 50s, the bowling alleys finally have to say, okay, if, you know, we have to work with the unions, so we need to desegregate. So that is another interesting story.
1955, Disneyland opens. A lot of people that are sort of on the Disney fan portion of the theme park fandom spectrum, the attitude as to how Walt Disney approached race is that he looked at entry to Disney as being a meritocracy, which is, you know, we've used the term problematic also, but it's a little questionable to sit there and say that it was a pure meritocracy that he was seeking. I'll let you try to explain what was the effect of racism, or what was the thought process of segregation with Disney? I mean, there were some items that
yeah. Well, there's a couple of historians who've argued that Disneyland was segregated, and that's actually not true. There's really no evidence at all that it was overtly in any way segregated. But Disney, what he does before Walt Disney, before he opens Disneyland, is he travels around the country and he visits these older parks. He visits, you know, Coney Island in Cincinnati, for example, and other parks. And he sees, you know, parts of the parks that are in decline that he wants to kind of think about differently. But he also sees that there are these incidents. There are demonstrations. There is violence. And he sees that those kinds of incidents happen in a few specific spaces, which are beaches and swimming pools, roller skating rinks, and dance halls. And none of those things appear in Disneyland. So he very self-consciously tries to, and there's plenty of evidence for this. So he's trying to create a park that will not lead to that kind of conflict. Obviously, Disneyland, this is no longer the case, but when it was opened, you could not get to it by public transportation. And that was a big issue because these older parks, of course, were trolley parks or sometimes steamboat parks, but you could get there without owning your own car. That's not the case at Disneyland. So that's another way to kind of separate it from the working class. In older parks, you could go into the park grounds without paying an entrance fee. So if you were a working class, you know, teenager, you could go to a Euclid Park or someplace like that, enter the grounds. And then you could buy tickets for rides or entrance into the roller skating rink or things, you know, those of those nature. But Disneyland has an entrance fee, a gate fee. So that's another big innovation, which a lot of these older parks then start to adopt. They copy Disney in doing that. So that there is a kind of class, you know, segregation from the gate as well. He also saw that the park police were often problematic. They're often local thugs. Who would beat up protesters. And so he hires these, you know, young men, dresses them up in very nice clothing and trains them to be extremely polite. So it's a different kind of policing that happens in Disneyland. So all that kind of comes together. And in his case, not all these theme parks were successful, but in his case, obviously it was extremely successful. So, and there weren't any, I mean, there were some extremely problematic racial stereotypes within Disneyland. There's the Jungle Ride, Aunt Jemima Pancake House, I believe it is. And there were some, I think there was a lawsuit and some protests in the late 60s by the NAACP to try to get Disneyland to hire African Americans in positions other than pretending to be African villagers or flipping pancakes. So that was the one civil rights protest in Disneyland, but that was pretty much it.
Yeah, I was actually going to specifically ask you about that, because that's a part that often gets very much left out is, you know, Disneyland essentially only providing what they consider on stage opportunities for individuals who are willing to play the part of either Uncle Ben or Aunt Jemima is unconscionable by today's standards, but was actually something that occurred. At that point, after the success of Disneyland, we see that the theme park industry begins to move to the suburbs. Essentially, there's a push from, it's mostly an internal push, but the idea is that the people with the money are now leaving the cities, they're moving to the suburbs, and we see theme parks be joined up with shopping facilities and large-scale residential communities that are being developed in places like Mason, Ohio, for instance, or trying to think of some other really good examples, Arlington, Texas, Marietta, Georgia, things like that. Do you have anything that you can talk about in terms of that shift to the suburbs and how it affects African-American and Hispanic or other minority communities?
Yeah, and working class white communities too, I mean, who don't have access or don't have the money. So this is part of a larger, you know, kind of story of the development of suburban America, how that's subsidized, you know, certainly by the federal government, and how cities in general become devalued, particularly after, say, 1968 and the kind of economic crises of the 1970s. So these really lavish kinds of recreational facilities that had been in cities, like those New Deal swimming pools, are in rapid decline. There's not a tax base in these cities to keep them up often. And as you know, I've already said, these older amusement parks start to close one after another. So there's just a lack of accessibility to urban leisure spaces on the part of recent immigrants. So you have a big increase in Asian and Latino immigrants by the 1970s. Working class white ethnics, as well as African Americans. So it really impacts them. And the theme parks that are successful in the suburbs, again, they're expensive. It's a little bit harder to get there. So there's a kind of class segregation that, you know, works around that. Disneyland's a little bit of an exception only because the city kind of overtakes it a little bit. So you can actually get there by public transportation eventually. And that kind of creates some interesting issues for them. But Disney World, they made sure that that would not be the case, that they, you know, bought enough land that they could kind of, quote unquote, protect it. But there is a way in which the rise of the theme park and the decline of these urban parks, you know, is a real loss for anybody who lives in a city who doesn't have either the means or the private transportation, like a car, to actually get to one of the newer theme parks.
This kind of brings us to the modern day, and I think there's a lot of very interesting questions to ask here. The first one that comes to my mind, and obviously you're a historian or not necessarily a sociologist working in the present day, but what is your feeling on how the current state of the American city, which is we're seeing a reurbanization that takes place, we're seeing a lot of people move back into cities. Definitely true throughout here in the Rust Belt. Obviously, you know, I live in the Lansing area. I actually live in East Lansing, close enough to walk to my office. Lansing is just down the street. I spend a lot of time in Detroit, and I've seen a tremendous amount of change in Detroit. Buffalo has seen change. Pittsburgh has seen dramatic change in the last 10 to 15 years. Cleveland, yep. Cincinnati. Do you see there being, gentrification is very controversial, but do you see there being any possible positive with the movement back of individuals into the city and the increasing tax base and what it may mean for public recreation in those urban environments?
Yeah, I do see that. And it's funny, I used to, you know, end my urban history classes, you know, on a down note. Now I end with this, you know, massive Latino migration to cities have revitalized a lot of cities in the Southwest and the West. The kind of thing that you're talking about in a city like Buffalo, it's actually been refugees in part that have helped to revitalize the city, which is completely fascinating. So there is some real sense of hope there. There's certainly, you know, a kind of multiracialism there as well. But I do worry about the recreational facilities, which may not seem like the most important thing when you're concerned about cities, but there's still a lot of these spaces, like roller skating rinks, for example. There's a whole urban, black, largely black roller skating scene that was extremely important. They have competitions, and it's really a space of safety, of play. It's a place, you know, where actually gang members would go and they'd roller skate together peacefully. And a lot of those are closing down. So I would love to see, you know, public entities, city governments invest in more recreational facilities and kind of think about this. We have problems here in Buffalo where the public pools aren't open until like July. So you have kids swimming in natural waters, right? And natural waters around here, it's got the Niagara Falls and Niagara River, are really dangerous. And so every summer you have a bunch of kids dying. And they're often immigrant and refugee children who are in those situations. So I would love to see some sort of recognition like you saw in the New Deal era, when they had these infrastructure projects and they were often, you know, recreational facilities, whether it was the national park or a big, you know, public swimming pool. But making things more public and more accessible, I think, would go a long way. There is a move in the New York City area and Brooklyn and other places to refurbish some of those old New Deal swimming facilities and reopen them and make them, you know, more integrated and more open. So there is some move towards that. But, you know, these cities are still struggling. So I don't know if that public investment is going to happen, but I'd love to see it.
Is there any reason that you would see, looking historically, to believe that private entities will be able to provide these sorts of things? Or my general theory is that's probably going to have to be with public money and public funds, which is A-okay with me, but for a lot of people is questionable. Do you see any reason that private entities would provide these sorts of recreational opportunities in cities?
I think if there was a public-private partnership, which happens with housing quite a lot, actually, these days, if there was some incentive for private investors to create these facilities by having some sort of public-private partnership, that might be a strategy. I think the focus is primarily on housing, and there's good reasons for that. And you know, some not so much in cities that have a lot of housing, but places where it's more scarce. But you can attach housing to recreational facilities, and that can lead to a decline in crime, of delinquency. I mean, there's all sorts of statistics around that. So it would probably have to be some sort of public-private partnership that would have to happen. But I mean, maybe somebody will open up another urban amusement park. I would love to see that. It takes a lot of land to do that, so that makes it more difficult. But that would be really interesting to see.
Do you look at places like Chicago or Detroit right now, which are experiencing pretty significant increases in crime? How much can something like public recreation, public outdoor or indoor recreation, what can that do for those communities, places like South or West Side Chicago, that may be able to better integrate those individuals who feel deeply alienated sort of back into the general community, or to at least just bring them some sort of joy or peace that may stem some of the violence that we've seen?
Right. I wish I had statistics off the top of my head about this, but certainly I think that has to be part of the overall strategy. And I know that after school programs have been shown to be quite successful. You know, if nothing else, it's actually a physical space where you know, young people can be safe and they can have alternatives so that they're not on the streets at moments that might be more dangerous. So if you have to choose between policing and policing strategies that are more militarized and so forth and problematic and, you know, this kind of alternative, I do think that recreational facilities can make a difference. I know that in terms of the roller skating rinks, I know in Los Angeles, that was actually a really important space of safety during the 80s and 90s, the sort of worst of the violence in places like Watts. They would actually go to this, you know, couple of different roller skating rinks. And it, you know, there's something to be said for pleasure too. So that is a kind of human right in a sense, that people should have access to spaces where they're safe, and where they can experience pleasure in a way that a middle-class family could also do.
Probably the only other book that I can think of that really touches on this subject, David Nassau, who's over at Harvard, I believe, he's either at Harvard or Columbia, he wrote a book called Going Out. He argued that there was it was a somewhat conscious attempt to create these racial and class divisions to create a more common white national culture. Do you see that as being the case, or would you disagree with his premise?
No, I think he's right. I think he overemphasized the sort of golden age narrative of the early 20th century. So I put more emphasis on the way in which the golden age is only a golden age for a certain group of people. But I think, and that book is enormously important, obviously, for the field in kind of historicizing and giving a social context for the development of recreation and popular culture. So that's very important. There's a book by Jeff Wilsey called Contested Waters. If anybody's interested in the swimming part of this, he wrote a really fascinating book about the whole kind of swimming pool story with both gender segregation and racial segregation. So he argues, for example, that when the pools were segregated by gender, which they were around the turn of the last century in 1880s, 1890s, and the first couple of decades of the 20th century, boys swam separately than girls. But then when they integrated them by gender, or boys and girls swam together, they segregated it by race. So that's another really interesting kind of take on this.
How do you feel, or do you feel, that the present day amusement industry, do you think it needs to perhaps recognize this past, these issues of race and class, and what can it do realistically within the bounds of being private companies? What do you think that they could do to possibly alleviate or fix or repair some of the damage that's been done?
Right. I would like them to have more recognition. And one of the things is that with the few parks that still exist, the older parks like Seabreeze outside of Rochester is a really good example. They actually market themselves on their nostalgia, and almost every ride will have a little historic plaque in front of it with a little description of the ride and so forth. If one could incorporate this racial history, this broader history into that kind of historicizing, into these documentaries. I've done a few interviews of documentaries that are happening now. I'm like, because I am, the only expert on segregation in amusement parks. So there are some documentary filmmakers and others who are beginning to sort of recognize this and grapple with it a bit more. But I think, it's difficult because then you become the sort of killjoy of people's childhood memories and childhood joy. And that's why it's largely shied away from. And I think there are ways to approach this and say, yes, those are positive child memories. Yes, that's completely valid. But there are these other children, like Martin Luther King's daughter. He describes her looking in through the bars of Funtown, where she can't go in. So having that memory as well, as part of this national memory, and maybe also trying to avoid these mistakes in the future and these problems in the future, kind of moving forward as well. There's been a little bit, actually the South, interestingly, in some ways has grappled with this legacy more than the North, because the history of slavery, segregation, and civil rights in the South is so palpable. So that you do actually have, more historic plaques, that kind of thing, throughout the South saying this park was segregated, et cetera. And in the North, you see very little of that. So I would love to have more acknowledgement. That's beginning to happen. In places like Michigan and Ohio and Illinois and New York about this longer legacy, and that they too were implicated in Jim Crow segregation.
Continuing a little bit with some of the, now the kind of questions that I have for you, because I have a lot of interest in this topic. Crystal Beach and Boblo Island, which was a amusement park that serviced the Detroit area, both of those were technically located in Canada. Is there any sort of similar history in Canada to this, or is it simply a situation of those parks which serviced American cities located in Canada had this issue?
Yeah, it's It's more that they are in proximity to the U.S. And indeed, the Babylon Island, there was a case that went up to the Supreme Court about that. But so Canada is really interesting in some ways that history is a little bit underwritten. There's this category we call the North Star myth, where Canada is this bastion of freedom for, you know, escaped enslaved people who crossed the Detroit River or crossed the Niagara River to escape into Canada, that it didn't have the same kind of legacy of legal segregation written into the laws. But that sort of romantic image of Canada is deeply problematic. And there have been some historians who've worked on that, although it's a little bit understudied. So the beaches, for example, on the Great Lakes in Canada seem to be largely segregated. And there's plenty of evidence for that. So there was issues around racial segregation in Canada as well. But I do think that Babylon Island and Crystal Beach are essentially extensions, and the Supreme Court agreed with this, of Detroit and of Buffalo. You do have certainly, you know, residents in Ontario who also went to those parks, but that there really are extensions in many ways of American cities. But that doesn't mean that Canada is not somewhat implicated in this legacy as well.
When I emailed you about the possibility of joining the podcast, I kind of had this question that popped in my mind because I've been doing some research on Louisiana. We had mentioned the Works Progress Administration earlier, and the Works Progress Administration, for those who don't know, listening to the podcast, which is certainly possible, in the 1930s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt spent a lot of money, the federal government's money, doing things like upgrading and constructing swimming pools and zoos across the United States. Louisiana was a little bit of a different story because their governor, Huey Long, did not get along very well with FDR. It's not that Huey Long was against the idea of spending federal money or reappropriating funds for these sorts of ventures. He sort of wanted to do more of it.
Right.
In a lot of ways, he was a populist, though very different from what we see as populism currently in government today. Did you have any insight on that? Were you able to obtain any insight?
Well, I mean, it's actually Huey Long's relationship to the Black community in Louisiana is a great kind of subject of debate, actually, among historians. It's really fascinating. But you're absolutely right. So his campaign, his Share Our Wealth is what he called it, was basically a plan to redistribute wealth in a much more or a more radical way than Franklin Roosevelt was willing to do. So he was essentially to the left of Roosevelt in terms of wanting to redistribute wealth and to use public works and infrastructure in order to help, you know, uplift working and poor people. So he actually had a lot of support in Louisiana among African Americans, although most of them could not vote at that point because of disfranchisement. So they most of them could not actually vote for him for governor or for Senate, but they did support him, and they supported him because at least they were getting something. So he was improving public education pretty dramatically in the state, which was in terrible shape. He was building infrastructure, and he did have some programs, for example, for sharecroppers and small farmers, which was, you know, he basically said this is for white farmers, but it also helped Black farmers as well. So, and he never ran his campaigns on a kind of white supremacist platform in the way that Bilbo and other white Democrats in the South were doing constantly in this period. So he didn't have that kind of overtly racist language in order to mobilize the white Democratic vote that many other leaders in the South did. So he's interesting. I mean, he's also incredibly corrupt and was mad for power. So he's a complicated figure. But probably, you know, overall, he did, you know, he definitely did things that helped helped African Americans, specifically in Louisiana and in many other states in the South. The New Deal programs for the unemployed, like the WPA, were administered on the local and state level, so they would pay African Americans less or exclude them from the rolls completely. There's all sorts of discrimination, racial discrimination, that was allowed to be carried out in those states. So programs like the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, had almost no African Americans, you know, who benefited from that. So compared to that, Louisiana was better, but still complicated story.
Okay. I mean, it basically answers the question I had. The question I had for those listening was essentially, was Huey Long's refusal to work with the WPA, which resulted in far fewer items being constructed in Louisiana. It was mostly post offices.
Right.
Was that either consciously or subconsciously some sort of effort to undermine recreational opportunities? And the answer definitely sounds like it was no, essentially.
Yeah, but it is, but you're right. I mean, it did limit what was done. So.
Right.
In this case.
Yeah, there's a lot here to sort of unpack in terms of this history. And if we get into specific parts, we could probably go on for hours at this stage. Because as you stated, you know, this is something that was prevalent throughout the North.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell sort of the public? This doesn't necessarily have to do with recreation itself, but just in general about how segregation, particularly in northern cities, operated through the 60s or even perhaps past.
Well, I guess I would say two things, one more negative and one maybe more hopeful. And on the more negative side, as I said a couple of times, I think what people sometimes fail to understand is the legacy of segregation. The way that certainly housing and residential segregation persists, as does school segregation. But even this older form of public accommodations, I think what happens over time is that even after the Civil Rights Act is passed, many whites associate spaces that have African Americans in them as spaces of danger, of potential danger. So, you know, don't go to that swimming pool, don't go to that park because there's black kids there, that kind of thing. And that's the legacy that, you know, one has to work really self-consciously against. On the more positive side, one of the things I say in the introduction to my book is, you know, I comb the records to look for all these incidents, both of segregation, but also of civil rights protests and violence, often riots. But what I don't write about as much are those spaces, even in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, where you did have interracial mixing that was peaceful. And those spaces did exist, certainly. There are a handful of amusement parks, in fact, but I know one in the Pacific Northwest that did not seem to be segregated. So it's not the case that every single one was or that every single swimming pool was. So that is also part of the legacy. And even though the theme parks are expensive and hard to get to for many people, they are, in fact, you know, very integrated these days. And actually, on an international level, if you go to Disney World, you know, it's filled with people from Brazil and Asia and all around the world. So there is a way in which there is a much more multiracial, a much more integrated atmosphere in those parks. You know, occasionally you'll get an incident here or there, but for the most part, I think that is a kind of sense of hope. It would just be nice to have those spaces available for people who had less money and less access to transportation. So
I guess if I'm going to close it on a question to you, it's going to be something on that intersection of race and class. Obviously, the idea of pure meritocracy when discussing race is a bit difficult because there are a number of issues which preclude people of various racial or ethnic backgrounds from often achieving or being given opportunities to achieve things financially. With that in mind, do you see anything currently that's happened in the last 10, 15, 20 years, outside of, for instance, you were talking about the Works Progress Administration pools in New York City that are being rehabilitated, that leads you to believe that we're looking towards a better future of more integrated entertainment, recreational opportunities?
I think that the current social movements, including the Black Lives Matter movement, have paid some attention to this. So, for example, the protests that happened in Baltimore, they actually did a bunch of protests outside of Camden Yards, in part to sort of talk about the ways in which that kind of, you know, that's in the city, but it's largely suburban white families who are coming into the city and going to Camden Yards. And so that was actually part of the conversation in Baltimore, which I found really fascinating. I do think that Black Lives Matter and other social movements, contemporary social movements, against, you know, militarization of police and mass incarceration have brought more attention to kind of the contemporary issues of race and segregation, and disabuse people perhaps that this is history and it's something in the past, but rather is something that needs to be grappled with today. So that's, you know, also somewhat hopeful. You know, in terms of public investment in this kind of thing, as happens in the New Deal, I don't know, maybe there's definitely nonpartisan or cross-partisan line support for infrastructure. So that's a possibility as well, but there's also a lot of kind of skepticism around that. So a mix, I guess.
All right. Dr. Victoria Wolcott, Chair of the Department of History at the University of Buffalo, thank you very much for joining me and discussing this topic. Again, definitely check out her book, Race, Rights, and Roller Coasters, The Struggle Over Segregated Recreation in America. You can go on Amazon and buy it. Is it available for e-readers as well as paper? I just have an old fashioned.
It is actually, it is an ebook as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an outstanding book. Highly, highly recommended. There's just very few items you can read in terms of the history of this industry that will give you this information. And this is easily the best one. Again, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.